Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you know this sound? It's an eastern screech owl, and although their exquisite camouflage makes them very hard to see, you can occasionally hear them at night here in North Texas if you're lucky enough to have one in the neighborhood. Actually, a number of owl species can thrive in this part of the country if we take care of the habitat that supports them. Owls help keep rodent and insect populations in check, they ignite our imaginations, and they are an important reminder that the distinction between wilderness and civilization is not as clear-cut as we might imagine. My guest has been seeking out these impressive birds for decades, creating safe places for them in his own yard and getting just close enough to observe and enjoy their presence in his life. Tony Angel served as supervisor of environmental education for Washington State's Department of Public Instruction for more than 30 years, and he's a natural history author and illustrator. His new book is called The House of Owls. Tony, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be here.
One thing I love about this book is how many of your observations really do come from your own backyard. We don't have to go far from home to appreciate wildlife.
I believe that's true. I think the biggest thing we need to exercise sometimes is patience, because owls obviously operate at a different time of the 24-hour cycle than we do, and they're most active in times that we don't get out and look around. But when we do, and particularly when we listen, we can begin to detect them in our communities.
Your yard was home to western screech owls for almost 25 years. How did you first become aware that they were there?
Well, I no sooner moved into the neighborhood than during a pretty ferocious northwest storm, the nesting tree of the owl was blown down. And when I examined it, I realized that an owl had been in there. There were feathers there. And I put up a nesting box. And then, no sooner had the box gone up, perhaps maybe a week or so, the male owl took this as prime real estate and began to call incessantly from the top of the box. So I knew that they had a pretty strong presence in that immediate little watershed that I was living in.
I hadn't realized until I read your book that owls don't build their own nests. So how do they choose places to live if there's no nesting box provided by a friendly neighbor?
Well, that is indeed a characteristic of owls, although the burrowing owl may improve on a badger burrow by digging a vestibule, and you have burrowing owls in Texas, and badgers too. But the owl generally will, the smaller owls in particular, use a cavity of a woodpecker, ranging from a pileated, our largest woodpecker, all the way down to a downy woodpecker, where the smallest of the owls will nest. And the woodpecker and owl dependency, if you will, I would say the owl is quite dependent upon the woodpecker for a nesting cavity. In lieu of a cavity, they'll use, like a great horned owl might, or in our case here in the Northwest, the northern spotted owl, could use an abandoned crow's nest or a hawk's nest. They'll even nest on the top of a mistletoe bundle up in a tree. Cleavages and cliffs, places in sycamore trees where branches break off and there's a cavity formed. These are perfect places for owls to settle into and lay their eggs and brood them and raise their young there.
How do burrowing owls ascertain that the badger or the other similarly unwelcoming previous resident is in fact gone?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the burrowing owl, of course, is one that's faced some diminishing habitat and circumstances where it can feed and breed. But they will go and investigate, of course. They will also dig a side vestibule off the main course of a burrow. But badgers and ground squirrels dig incessantly. And it's very likely they're going to find an unoccupied burrow. And in case they don't, where everything from a badger to a rattlesnake could descend into the burrow, the burrowing owl has developed capacities to escape out other entrances, but also to defend their burrow by imitating the sound of a rattlesnake. Not that the sound of a rattlesnake is going to deter another rattlesnake, but it certainly is going to discourage a badger from coming in if they hear this rattling sound that the burrowing owl is quite capable of producing. Another thing that they apparently do is decorate the entrances, particularly, or right into an entrance, with the dung of range animals. And by placing the dung in those areas, the immediate sense of the burrowing owl is not detected. And if anything, an animal approaching it would be discouraged from going any further.
What does a good nesting box need, and how is that differentiated from just something that we would look at and call a large birdhouse?
Well, the owl box needs to be, in particular cases like the eastern screech owl and the western screech owl, it should be the same diameter, as I'm talking about the entry hole for the box, as that of a flicker. The flicker is about a 3-inch diameter entry hole, and that suits the diameter of the owl's body perfectly and also discourages predators from getting in through that hole down into the nest itself. It ought to be probably 18 inches between the lip of that hole down to the bottom. Again, that gives some distance between the immediate brood and any predator that might try to enter the nest. It ought to be perhaps 12 inches square on the side. And when you place a box, and you're going to typically place it where you think owls are present, it ought to be at least 18 feet, perhaps 20 feet high, if possible. And in the case of the box that I put up that hosted owls for over 25 years, the box was facing to the east. It would get the morning sun under the boughs of the tree. It wouldn't get the intense afternoon sun where the box would heat up and the youngsters would suffer.
You mentioned that you had your owls for about 25 years in your yard. They were actually displaced by another kind of owl, right?
Well, that's true. The very aggressive barred owl has become something of a serious consideration when you look at the sustainability of the smaller owls. And even the spotted owl has suffered from the presence of the barred owl. It moved west from the East Coast perhaps half a century ago, and established itself immediately. We might say that we built the road west for the barred owl, because any place we put a park and planted trees, crows would nest, hawks would nest in the trees, and the barred owl followed right behind them, used those nests for their own brood, and continued to move west and then down the west coast. The owls in my neighborhood, as I say, they were around for 25. They didn't nest that entire quarter century, all the way up to the last year, they were present, and in came the barred owls very aggressively and both drove them out and also captured the young owls. So they were in no way encouraged to remain in my community because of the threat of the bigger, more aggressive barred owl.
I want to listen to some barred owl sound here. Is there a particular message with a cry like that, Tony?
Well,
other than get out of my nesting box?
Well, I think the barred owl is often referred to as the owl that calls, who cooks for you all? And if you listen carefully, you can kind of pick that up. It's a favorite one of mine to imitate when I'm talking to audiences that fall asleep in front of me, because it wakes them up right away, looking around, wondering, what in goodness name is that? And they have, however, including that call, a variety of cackles and yodels and croaks, all of which have shades of meaning, but the principal calls are to indicate that that bird is present in the territory. This is territory that owl claims, and it's also used in the courtship. When the courtship gets going, they really shift into a high gear of a repertoire of sounds that are almost unbelievable when it comes to considering that a bird can produce it. And as I say, now that the barred owl has established itself in my little watershed, I am privy to those calls. And again, they amaze me at their range and versatility.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Greetings. Thanks for the program. This is great fun.
Oh, good.
I had an old speaker box, like a stereo speaker box, and I didn't want to just chuck it away, so I actually have a neighbor who had has screech owls. I put it up in my tree and just strapped it up there. Within a week, I had an eastern screech owl in it,
wow,
which was just great fun. But I've got two questions for you. One is, that owl is now taken off. It took off just recently and hasn't come back. I'm wondering, how do I keep squirrels out of the thing? And secondly, how many boxes? I've got 3/4 acre. How many boxes could I put up to draw more in?
Thanks for your call.
In answer to the question, squirrels are always going to be a threat to occupying an owl box. They can get in there, and it's a natural cavity that will attract them. A live trap for the squirrel, and I assume it's an eastern gray squirrel, is the most suitable thing to get them out of the immediate area. You're going to have to release them somewhere where maybe they're accepted. And you may have to continue that to catch the pair of squirrels or the ones, the subsequent squirrels that come in. It may be an ongoing process, but it is important. Capacity for an owl to breed in and occupy, a pair of owls breed in and occupy a space smaller than an acre is very, very problematic for the owl and unlikely. I don't think you would get more than a single pair within that range because they're going to go well outside your property to forage for their young and for themselves. The young themselves, of course, after they fledge, disperse and find their own territories and begin to set up their range and raise their families. The one example I have of close competition with the owls, our western screech owls, was one year when the pair of owls that had claimed the nesting box as prime real estate were challenged by another pair of owls that also liked it very early in the breeding season. And their competition back and forth, the edge of the territory, which was the road that fronted our house, was intense. And I would sit on the porch and listen to it. Well, you can imagine somebody sitting and listening to owl calls for hours, but I have, and it's been entertaining. That they would compete and did so over a week before the invading pair finally gave up. They realized that the other pair were too powerful, and they found their own home farther down the creek.
And I suppose they have to be geographically distributed because there are only so many rodents and small birds and things to eat. Is that the reason why they are not close together?
Well, you'll find some places, for instance, where the barn owl has been introduced as a predator control species in Napa Valley, rather than using pesticides on what is doing the vines their damage, they introduced barn owls and nesting boxes. And there, because of the saturation of small rodents, they have boxes within view of one another where pairs of owls raise young and are able to supply sufficient amounts of rodents to their progeny, which sometimes may be 6 or 8 young owls. So it just depends on the density. Where snowy owls nest in the Arctic, when there's a great lemming population, big swell of lemming, the adults are primed for reproduction.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is Tony Angel. His new book is called The House of Owls. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with natural history author, illustrator, and educator Tony Angel. His new book is called The House of Owls. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Tony, before the break, you were saying, for example, with snowy owls, if there are plenty of lemmings, you can have plenty of snowy owls in any given area.
That is the case, and you're going to have snowy owls nesting in closer proximity because there's an abundance. The territory doesn't have to be as vast. You're also going to have a more vigorous number of owlets that are going to fledge. When we get into the periodic eruptions of snowy owls, when they come all the way from the Arctic, as far south, of course, as the southern United States, including Texas. And in years past, they've gotten even to Bermuda. This is in part based on the lack of a food supply, where the young birds of the year or the year before are driven out of the Arctic by the established adults up there that will maintain their immediate areas throughout the year. And then the other younger owls have to forage for prey farther south, which accounts for why they're here. It's a prey-based economy, if you will, and it really determines and influences the movement of owls, because owls in general are not migratory. They'll stay within an immediate area throughout their lifetime. Some smaller owls, like the saw-whet owl, will move down the eastern coast of North America. They'll also go across Canada, all the way from Vancouver Island clear across to Ontario. They'll wander, and sometimes we get these remarkable banded birds that show up 2,500 miles from where they were banded, moving from Canada all the way down into close to the Mexican border.
I learned so many things reading this book. I think the thing that will stick with me is that owls, they look big and heavy, particularly the larger species of owl, but they tend to be pretty light, and a lot of what looks like mass is really just feathers.
This is a characteristic of most owls. Some of the smaller owls are packed together with feathers that are more consistent with what we think a bird's feathers should be. But the owls like the great gray owl, even great horned owls and snowy owls, will not weigh nearly as much as their appearance suggests. In the book, I note how a friend of mine, who is very familiar with the outdoors and nature, ran into an owl, a great horned owl, which, of course, you have plenty of great horned owls, I hope, in Texas. It's part of its range. But the owl flew into his windshield when he was going down the highway about 55. The owl probably came up at 35. But you had a combined speed of this owl hitting his windshield, and it took the windshield out. And he said to me, that owl had to weigh at least 50 pounds. Well, fact is, it probably weighed 3.5 or 4 pounds, but it certainly looked as big as a 50-pound dog, and with that acceleration, hit it like a 3.5 or 4-pound cannonball would have hit that windshield and took it out. I will say this: the owls have a pretty remarkable range. There are some 217 species worldwide. They have a range from the very, very diminutive elf owl, which has a southwestern range that may just edge into portions of Texas. And it's not any heavier than a medium-sized hen's egg.
Wow.
And it's about the size of a sparrow. On the other end of the continuum, you have the Blakiston's fishing owl, which will weigh as much as 12 to 14 pounds. And that's as big or bigger than any of the eagles that we have in North America. And they're capable of pulling big salmon out of rivers, where they range far up in the Siberian area of the Arctic.
Now, if a gentleman is interested in a lady, he might bring her a box of chocolates. How does it work if a male owl is interested in a female owl?
Well, to our knowledge, owls have never taken a great liking to chocolate, but you never know. It could open up. The equivalent, and we're not anthropomorphizing here, it's a gifting, like we would gift one another to demonstrate something, our amorous intentions, our capacity to provide something for our mates. Owls will deliver prey, and the males in particular are almost exclusively going to bring prey to the female early in the courtship period. And they do it in and around the nesting cavity, again, to get the female's interest. And by the way, owls appear, most of them, most of the species, to keep the same pair throughout their lifetime. If one is injured or killed, they'll replace the mate. But that gifting is a very, very significant part of that courtship process in owls. And once the female is on the eggs, that gifting, if you will, continues throughout that incubation and brooding period, because the male is the sole provider for the very first several weeks that the female is on the eggs and with the youngsters. He has to continually bring food, feeding at first the mate and then the youngsters, and then eventually the female can leave the youngsters and begin hunting for the family as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Craig in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's great that you have a guest that's speaking about owls. I'm a big fan of owls. I went to Florida Atlantic University down in Florida, and that was our mascot, was the burrowing owl.
Oh, great.
Of course, we lost a lot of those to cats that kind of started being fed by students and other people and so forth. And that's kind of one of the things I wanted to ask about is your guest was talking about owl houses, and I've tried to put up some owl houses, but they keep on being occupied by the European starlings, and I was just wondering if he has any suggestions on how to keep those birds out and encourage the owls to take up residence there.
Well, yeah, the European starling, opportunistic cavity user, and I had European starlings move into my nesting box early on. The initial action that I wanted to take was to trap and eliminate the starlings. They are not in great populations in our watershed area, but again, they're aggressive and opportunistic. In this particular year, and with this particular pair of screech owls, the resident screech owl saw the occupancy of the starlings and the interest in the starlings, and the pair of owls killed the starlings and ate them. Now, that's a pretty direct and efficient way of reducing the competition. And I never had another problem with the starlings. But you're absolutely right. Sometimes you just have to yourself get up and take out the nesting material that the starlings will bring in, because owls don't typically add much other than the down of the females from her brood patches. They'll use the substrate of the wooden box, and that's why sometimes you ought to rough up the substrate and put in a few wood chips for them. But taking that nesting material out immediately, once you see the interest of the starlings, will begin to discourage them, because starlings are also smart, and they get the message. There are all kinds of examples of species that will get in with the owls. You may have another question, but I've always been interested to find that snakes themselves make their way sometimes into owl nests. And Fred and Nancy Gelbach, who are probably the most esteemed and recognized researchers on owls, who are from and live in Texas, found that blind snakes will be in the nests of the eastern screech owl in the study areas that they had in and around Waco. And what happens is that it appears that there's a commensal relationship, because the owls will tolerate the blind snakes. They don't eat them. They may even transport them to the nest because they consume the parasites in the nest that sometimes appear in the food that the owls will bring. And to reduce the impact of those parasites or anything that might be an insect that could be have a negative impact on the young owlets, those snakes will patrol and feed on what is in the nest. So it's a remarkable relationship between those snakes and the owls.
Wow. You are really good in the book about not anthropomorphizing, but like pretty much anybody that is human, you find owlets really charming and adorable. Can you talk a little bit about what they're like when you're first able to observe them and they're peeping out of the nest?
Well, you picked one of my favorite moments in that drawing I depicted because year after year I would get out and try to be there when the owlets first encountered the world beyond the box. And I was just every single time struck by what appeared to be so analogous to what a young child in a sense of awe might have for seeing some animal, flower, insect, something for the first time where you can see their mouth drop and their eyes widen and they begin to embrace what's ahead of them. The owlets appear to do the same thing. And every generation that I watched among the owls had that response. When I would appear up underneath the nest, and by the way, over that period of time, the adult owls accepted me, and I could hang out practically with an arm's length. And owls do recognize individuals, just like corvids, crows do, a little bit differently. But they understand they have parts of their brain that are essential for all the memories that they can bring up, their hippocampus. They have images of things and objects and people that they can trust, and they adjust their behavior accordingly. And these owls did. And those young owls, of course, being innocent, had yet not yet learned to fear any human. So they found great interest in me. The other part of that question that I was thinking to respond to is the fact that owls, with the eyes in the front of their face, are so human-like. Mm-hmm. They look a little bit like people. And I don't know, we've all met people from time to time who are owl-like, I guess. And that's not a negative observation as much as it's they're wide-eyed, they're inquisitive, they're looking, they maybe move their head a little bit to get a better perspective, just like an owl might. And that's not been lost on generations or people, I should say, in general, for thousands and thousands of years. And all those early depictions, the cave paintings in Chevet of the eagle owl, demonstrate how human-like they appear with all the mysteries that are packed into their behavior and life.
It is interesting that so many different cultures have thought of owls as being particularly inquisitive or wise, but not all cultures have seen them as like harbingers of good luck or happy things. Sometimes we associate them with what is frightening and mysterious.
Absolutely. I was listening to a program this morning on NPR about villages in Africa who the people therein listening to many of the owls in their immediate area place a great deal of fear in their direction and concern, suggesting an owl call that death is imminent. Another country, maybe even adjoining with a slightly different cultural approach to owls in Africa, would see it entirely different. An owl call is good luck. An owl in and around a home will foretell a good birth, a smooth and easy birth and a happy child. There's just this variety that people respond to owls with that becomes invested into some cultural belief. And that's true throughout the world. And as I said earlier, with all the species and niches that owls are capable of occupying, other than Antarctica, the people there are going to respond to owls in a variety of ways.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Maggie.
Hello. Mr. Angel, I met you years ago at college. I went to Western, and I was at Huxley College. And
I'm
glad to see you're still active. John Miles was teaching a class I think you spoke to. While I was listening, I was reminded of an owlet story of my own. I was a ranger naturalist in Central Texas and was called over to see an unfledged owlet on the ground under the tree. And as we were looking at it, wondering what to do, this little thing just climbed the tree. Those talons just walked back up to the nest. So we were amazed. I wanted to ask you about the natural tendency to think that owls are top as far as being left alone by other birds. I think I've actually seen them. I've seen them driven off by crows, and I think last year I actually heard what was an owl being killed by crows. Is that something that you're aware of?
That's very true. Crows, as you may know, a collection of crows is referred to as a murder of crows, and they've earned that reputation by taking down with their numbers and almost an insane reaction, at least that's the way we might describe it, to a predator and mobbing it and colliding with it. And they've taken down bald eagles up here in the Northwest. And when it comes to the smaller owls, they're definitely in jeopardy. And I describe one episode in my book of being hailed, not by the owls, but by the cacophony of scolding crows to go over to the other side of my home and investigate because they were mobbing the fledgling owls that had been out of the nest only a few days. And if you ever want to feel helpless in the face of which I just have to tell you, I think my entire family really loved these birds. For 25 years, you get a connection that is a magnificent feeling because you start to connect with other living things like it's very, very different than others.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Tony Angel. His new book is called The House of Owls. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Dean was told by Parvati that... Please don't ask me to say it again. Hagrid's looking for you.
Well, you can tell Ronald...
I'm not an owl!
That is the characters Hermione Granger and Harry Potter in one of the Harry Potter movies. And if you have familiarity with the series, you know that owls in Harry Potter serve as companions and messengers. Did you like the way they used owls in Harry Potter, Tony?
Well, I did. I noted that the wisdom factor that I think the Greeks were the first to really describe it, put owls on coins, and then that was carried on by the Romans and into the literature of Europe and contemporary literature in Harry Potter about how the wise owl will convey the important message to the people that need to listen. And I did like that.
Tony Angel is my guest. He's a natural history author and illustrator and author of the new book, The House of Owls. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You were talking earlier about, you know, it's not always easy to see an owl, but we can use our ears. And we have just a tiny little bit of sound here of a horned owl that I want to play. That is kind of what people imagine when they think of an owl call. But it does seem that maybe we're hearing owls in nature, and if we're not familiar with their calls, maybe there are many species of owls that we don't realize we're hearing.
Indeed. I think one of the most unusual owls that I've heard would be the saw-whet. Its call sounds like somebody is sharpening a saw, a scraping, short scraping call. The barn owl, which, of course, in and around the farming communities of North America, the barn owl, it's co-evolved with people, has taken advantage of all the rodents that we are able to attract. And you will hear them at night screaming and screeching and hissing as part of their repertoire. Not the regular wilderness kind of hoot that it's in a way it's a stereotypical kind of use of the great horned owl because they are so versatile in their calls. One of the things I might say is that over the years, even as a young kid, I would detect the movie industry using what they thought were owl calls to convey the sense of mystery and intrigue and work up the mood of the observer, like the Dracula films and the werewolf films, and you'd hear this. Well, they never used owls. They used mourning doves, and the cooing rather than the hooting didn't quite do it for me. It got me off on the wrong track. I was like, what are they using doves for in the middle of the night? Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Greg in Arlington. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My house backs up to a creek, a wooded creek, and been feeding songbirds for several years and considered putting up an eastern screech owl box, but I wondered, will that equal a death sentence for the songbirds that are visiting my feeders?
Thanks for your call.
The question again was, you wondered?
Putting up an owl box for screech owls or attracting them, will that be bad for the songbirds in the area?
Okay, that's what I thought you'd ask. Well, they're definitely going to take the prey they need to catch. I've been privy to watching my resident owls over those years catch only an occasional a songbird. They caught the thrush down the creek. If they heard the call, they knew that there was a thrush in the throes of calling, and very often they'd catch one. Each year, I would clean out the nesting box just in case there was something in there that, like a parasite or something that could hold over into the next year. I would clean out the box so they'd have a fresh box, and I'd also examine what was in it in the way of their castings or the detritus of the nesting aftermath, to examine what it was that they ate. Songbirds represented probably only about 0.1% of what they were consuming on my watershed. And we had everything from western tanagers, the local thrush, juncos, and chickadees. But mostly they were consuming small rats, young rats, lots of mice, and moreover, catching crayfish and trout out of our stream. And in one year, I guess, when the trout and crayfish were in short supply, they ate almost nothing more than carpenter ants, which was great for everybody along the creek shed because carpenter ants can do a great deal of damage to homes. But the older trees had been infested with carpenter ants. The owls took advantage, and that was where their diet was directed. I suppose if you get eastern screech owls, you need to keep an eye on it. But my sense is that if the songbirds are common, they might lose a few to the screech owls. But the benefits you'd get from the owls and what they're going to consume in the rodent population and the insect population will far outweigh the impact they might have on your songbirds.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guest. In my backyard, I live in Plano, and in my backyard, I see only one kind of one species of squirrel. I see only one species of rabbit. Most of the animals, I only see one species of, except for the birds. I think I've seen about maybe 15 or 20 different species. Why is there so much diversity in such a small area among the birds? Is it only because they can fly? How do they know who to mate with, and why have they not evolved into maybe one species in a certain area?
Interesting questions. Well, thanks.
That is an interesting question. I think there are a lot of ways of approaching it. I don't know that I would fully be able to answer that, but birds, and I can use the owls as an example, occupy different niches. Habitat is where you live. A niche is what you do to earn your living there. And songbirds are going to eat a variety of food. Some of them are insectivorous. Some of them are going to eat fruit and nuts. Some of them aren't going to eat the same insects. Some of them are going to pull worms out of your lawn, dig down into the understory and the substrate to pull out invertebrates down underneath the leaves. They just move and feed in a variety of places, and that range of species allows those niches to be exploited. If they were all one species, they would be eating, likely as not, all of the same thing. So you must have a very rich and diverse range of niches for those birds to select if you're counting, 12, 14, 15 different species. That, I think, is a very healthy habitat that you have for your bird population.
One thing that people should realize is that anyone who is using like warfarin or blood thinners to reduce the rodent population in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. that can have a direct deleterious impact on their predators who then eat them and are contaminated.
You bet. Putting out a product to take out your rat population can very well be transferred through the food chain to a predatory bird. And there have been studies demonstrating in the barn owl populations up here in our neck of the woods where the birds have suffered from that blood thinning agent that is used to kill the rats. So be very careful in what you apply. And again, getting back to letting nature do its work, there are other non-poisonous ways, including, as I mentioned earlier, having the barn owls take out the rodents in the Napa Valley big time and save literally millions of dollars over the years in what it would otherwise have cost the many vineyards to invest in controlling rodents there.
Owls don't have actual teeth, so how do they digest a rodent that is pretty big relative to their body size?
Yeah, owls, like hawks, will bolt down their food, owls more so than, say, hawks, which, by the way, owls and hawks, although they may look the same, they are very distinct orders of birds, very different orders of birds. They've just had a process of convergent evolution coming to the same kind of activity at different times of the 24-hour cycle. But they'll bolt their food whole, and their very strong muscled gullet will work down there with juices in the gullet to dissolve the edible parts and then roll up what's inedible into what they call a pellet or a casting. And then they will reverse peristalsis, so to speak, throw out the pellet out of their mouth while all of the essential elements, the nutritional elements, remain with the owl. Owls will tear their food up with their powerful beak, but they'll also render it in some cases by crushing it, crushing the skull. But the study of castings, I think, that is a routine thing to do in some science classes, will reveal an entire mouse skeleton that looks like it had been prepared by some specialist in the field of skeletons. And you can just lay it out, each bone intact, because all that has been dissolved is the edible portion of that mouse.
Let's go to the phone one more time. We have Michelle on the line in University Park. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. The timing of this interview is perfect because I'm taking a class tonight on owls. This is great. But I had a question. A few years ago, I was sitting in my backyard here in University Park reading a book, And three white owls landed on the chair in front of me and just stared at me for about a minute and a half, and then flew off. And I thought, first, is that a rare experience, especially here? And what kind of owl would that be to have three white owls land right in front of me?
Well, a number of things could account for that. What time of year was it?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, let's assume that it was sometime during the late spring or early summer, and these could have been nest mates. I would guess that they were barn owls that have a very white plumage, especially if they're facing you. Their breast is a creamy white color. And those young fledgling birds, and they're a medium-sized owl, could very well have been moving together. There was probably a nest not too far away. And one would land, the other one would land, and being innocent and curious, you were an object that they wanted to get a better measure of. I've had owls in the wild do similar things, not in those numbers. My other guess would be that they were young screech owls with the light plumage, light gray plumage, not fully adult yet, and they too could have come down and landed in front of you. And they are a smaller owl than the barn owl, but probably young birds that were innocent and easily approached you without fear.
If we find an owlet out of the nest, is it okay to try to put it back, or what should we do?
When owls fledge, when birds fledge in general, they're out of the nest. They're gone, and they want to stay out of the nest. They're on their way. On the other hand, they need to get up off the ground because of the cats, the dogs, the raccoon, the possum, all the ground predators are going to get them. And as was noted earlier by one of the callers, they can climb. They can jump back in. And I have an illustration in the book showing just how the screech owls were capable of getting back into a roost on their own. That does not mean from time to time over those 25, 24 years, I didn't give them what might be a leg up. And I think that's what all of us would consider doing to be helpful. But the owl adults are around. They're watchful. You should probably step back and see what happens. If it's threatened, get it up off the ground and onto a perch. But on the other hand, our biggest challenge is not just getting owls up off the ground, but it's maintaining their habitat, listening for them, caring for them, and receiving some of their gifts, which are enormous from the standpoint of opening up nature and telling us what's going on.
Tony Angel served as Supervisor of Environmental Education for Washington State's Department of Public Instruction for more than 30 years. He is a natural history author and illustrator of the new book, The House of Owls. Tony, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure indeed. Thank you for the interest.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.